just to review the general structure of our Zman this semester, we talked about topics throughout that addressed our obligations as a society, our obligations towards each other, and one of the more direct themes that linked everything that we spoke about is the theme of kriya, the idea that some obligations are so relevant to your functioning within society, and vice versa, society is so responsible towards its members that there could be room for some type of compulsion, for some type of social coercion. So the first half of the Zman, we spoke about staka topics, which don't run both themes, and that we reviewed already. And we talked about, towards the end of that, the idea that staka is subject to kriya. It's subject, at least under some circumstances and with some caveats, to being compelled. So we segued for the second half of this month to talk about the idea of kriya in general, kriya by mitzvos, and then more recently to talk about how that is applied to the more complex area of gittin, when kriya is appropriate and what makes it work and how and why and where does it work. So to start first talking about the whole concept of kriya, so all of these topics are ksubas topics in different places. Kriya in general by mitzvos is the Gemara Maseches Ksubas and Daf Pei Vav, where we find a reference to the concept of kriya by mitzvos aseh in the context, which we mentioned in last week's parshas here, of priyas bal chov mitzvah. We mentioned that Rashi explains it as connected to this past week's parsha, to the Revi of Parshas Kedoshim. Hain tzedek and lav tzedek, you're obligated to uphold your word. So therefore, there's a mitzvah saseh to pay back your loan. So the Gemara in that context talks about kfiya as a function of that mitzvah, and has the phrase ad shetetzei nafsho. Now, what exactly does ad shetetzei nafsho mean? It sounds quite extreme. Hopefully, it doesn't necessarily mean ad v'ad b'chlal, that the person's neshama should leave. The Shita Mekubetza suggests that it means that you're trying to get rid of his resistance, trying to get rid of that nefesh part, so to speak. And that's evocative of the Rambam that we'll talk about in a little while. So we had a couple of questions that we wanted to talk about. First of all, we have to know when this makes sense and what doesn't make sense, that not by all mitzvos does it make sense. And we know that the Gemara Maseches Erechin tells us that in the context of Tochacha, that Tochacha only should be applied when it makes sense, when you're going to be effective in changing somebody's mind. And Kishen Shemitzvah Lomar Davar HaNishma, Kach Mitzvah Lolomar Davar Shena Nishma. So there are times when it makes sense, times when it doesn't make sense. Now, the question could be asked in general, whether Kfiya itself is a function of Tochacha. And this is a topic that was discussed in the Shuvah Schikri Leit and others, that on the one hand, we could see Tochacha and Kfiya as connected, that Kfiya is a function of Mitzvah Tochacha, or it could be that Kfiya is a function of the concept of Arvus, of the idea that we are inter-responsible for each other, and therefore that responsibility would express itself by trying to influence the performance of mitzvos. There is also the possibility, which we ultimately found to be a little bit less likely, that the concept is there as a type of onesh. So in the context, the question of whether it's productive, whether it's not productive, we mentioned also in the context of staka. So it's interesting, we started off the staka topic, so we highlighted the fact that it's a little bit funny to see kfiya applied by staka, because on the one hand, staka is a common need. On the other hand, it would seem like staka draws on a midas harachmanis, which is not subject to kfiya, and also there are so many elements that are subjective and not necessarily easily assessed in terms of what a person's personal capabilities are in staka. So that's a part of the question we're going to have in general when it comes to mitzvos. So it's also noteworthy that we find that there is a focus on mitzvahs asei, specifically in the language of the Gemara and some of the Rishonim. We ask the question, is that agreed upon by all? Some of the Rishonim do mention mitzvahs asei as the subject of kfiyah, most well known. The other side is a Tosfos that we saw in the context of Staka. And Tosfos in Daf Mem Testament Beis asked the question why it is that we should have a concept of kfiyah by Staka if Staka is an area where there is matan schara b'tzida, where we're told that there is a reward for tzedakah, and we normally have a principle that we're not kofa on a mitzvah where matan schara b'tzida. So to that, Tosfos says, well, yes, but tzedakah also has losa says, so we are going to be kofa for that. So it sounds like from Tosfos that we're kofa on losa says also. So, what's the idea that we should be kofa on assays? It sounds a little bit funny because, first of all, assays in general, to focus on assays as the subject of fear, sounds a little bit funny for a few reasons. One is that we generally assume that mitzvahs assay are less chumra than mitzvahs lo assay. So, to focus on that as an area where we're going to exert this coercion is itself surprising. And also, how do we identify the moment when it's relevant? How do we know when somebody is considered to be mevatel an aseh? This is a topic of a major machlokas in the context of bris milah. And when it comes to bris milah, so we know the Torah has a punishment of kares for somebody who is mevatel bris. And the Rishonim, and the Rambam, and the Ragbid, and others have to try to figure out, what does that mean to be mevatel bris? Does it mean that only when you die without a bris milah, so then you are in negation of the mitzvah, or does it mean that every minute past the eighth day there is a bittul asei? Not to mention this the first time around, that was the topic of the famous machlokas between the Dvar Avram and everyone else. Did I mention this point? It's just interesting that the Dvar Avram had a tshuva where he said that let's say you have, for some reason, you have two babies that are your responsibility to do a bris milah for. One is bismana, one is an 8-day old baby, and one is not bismana. So which bris should you do first? So Dvar Avram said that you should do the baby shalom bismana first, because the bris at the 8th day, so even though we say it's reason makdimu l'mitzvos, you should do it as early as possible, but that's maila. Okay, that's a preference that we'd rather you do as reason makdimu l'mitzvos. But technically speaking, as far as the ikar halacha is concerned, that whole eighth day is all equal. If it's the morning, if it's the afternoon, it's not really different. While in the case of the baby that's already past the eighth day, so then he's now chayiv kares for every minute that he delays, so therefore you have to try to get to it as quickly as possible. That becomes a more urgent priority. And a lot of achronim disagreed. They said, what are you talking about? The eighth day is the bismano, it's mekudesh yoser, therefore that should take priority. If you look in the Macheshes and a few others, the Zeche Yitzchak, the Panit Yisrael, so they all argue on this Dvar Avram. And if you look in the beginning of Chelek Beis, the Dvar Avram, so it's like letters to the editor, the first few simanim, is all responding to those who argue with him on this point. It was a major machlokas. I don't know how often it comes up, but it still is a major machlokas. And the issue is this question of, do we say that you're mevatel the assay constantly, or it's only in the long run? And that highlights the difficulty of figuring out what does it mean to be against an assay? What does it mean to be skipping out on a mitzvah assay? So the idea that you have an onesh, so to speak, for this is a tricky concept. So there are some who try to understand it in the context of onesh. It sounds like that from Rabbeinu Yonah. The Shari Tshuva seems to have it in that context, talking about various statements in the Gemara that seem to criticize somebody who doesn't do a mitzvah with severe terminology. On the one hand, you find it in the context of tefillin, that kakach l'manach tefillin, a head that never put on tefillin, is considered to be a poshei Yisrael b'gufa, and is considered to be a sinner with his body. Discussion whether or not that's a good proof. The Gemara also says that the idan rischa, that in times of anger, so God punishes even on a bitul asei, which is also an interesting discussion. But practically speaking, Rav Asher Weiss, in the discussion of this, so he doesn't think Rav Yonah necessarily means it in any of those contexts, because it's difficult how to necessarily say that even if the onesh really applies, even if you should say that the person is chayiv for the bittul aseh, but the bittul aseh hasn't taken place yet. So it's difficult to view it that way.
Didn't the Shari Tshuva specifically say it was an onesh, though? Like, it wasn't really implying it. It seems to say, like, really outright. And Rav Asher Weiss said, no, he doesn't mean that.
Right. So he assumes that the term is not literal. I agree with you that the language lends itself to more of an onesh interpretation. He happens to think that just logically speaking, it's not really applicable, and you have to reinterpret his words. I grant you that the language doesn't really help us. Something's so wrong with that.
Cool.
Oh. No, they say time flies, but it's just been really distracting. Okay, somebody who's really eager to shoot in. All right. Sorry? First I was trying to figure out if it was a second hand, but it still didn't make sense even for a minute. Alright, any event, but whatever it is, it's a little distracting. Maybe just leave it on the table because it really is not helpful. It's like a sefer she'eino muga, and you can't have a sefer that's going to be misleading. This is what we discussed on Thursday's parshas here. You have midos and mishkalos, you have the measuring tools that are giving you the wrong measurement, so you're not allowed to have it. So to have a clock like that on the wall is probably more of a distraction than anything else. And, even the famous mimer that a broken clock is right twice a day is not going to apply to that clock, so nor is it going to work through subtraction. So probably better off if you shouldn't have it on the wall. So that's part of the message of Midos and Mishkalos and Parshas Kedoshim. In any event, so the idea that it's a punishment is a little bit harder to sustain, and the idea that it's really about deterring the misbehavior is a little bit easier. So you could say that if you want to assume that it's specifically about mitzvah saseh, so then you could say that the point is, the aseh you can still fix, you can still do it, which it sounds very much from Rashi's language that that's the idea, that it's still possible to do the aseh, which is why we are going to exert this pressure. While if you violate the losa aseh, so it's done, there's nothing you can do about it. So there's no point in exerting pressure at that point. Which is why also there are some achronim who maintain that even if you want to say like Tosfos and you want to extend it to losa aseh, but there's still a difference between los aseis that are ongoing, and therefore the point is to stop it from continuing. And in that case, we classify the aseis here. It's an interesting point that this is not necessarily begether onesh. This is begether trying to correct the behavior. So whether it's a los asei or asei, while there's still time to change course, so maybe that's where this comes up. And also, as some achronim will point out, only if it will change course. Bar Samech had a comment along those lines that if even through the exertion of coercion you're still not going to get it to do it, so then that's not going to necessarily be productive. I think we discussed the Sharm Tziyan and Bahalacha who raised the question. The Gemara has the example of Sukkah Eini Osa. So first of all, everyone asks Sukkah Eini Osa, you don't have to make a Sukkah in the first place. There is no mitzvah to make a Sukkah. The mitzvah is to eat in the Sukkah. Still some type of a hashem mitzvah to say to make a sukkah. But even if we assume, like some read it, that it means to eat in the sukkah, in this context and other contexts. So the Sharm Shiyan Bahalaka asks, so practically speaking, what does that mean? That eating in the sukkah is applicable as a chiyuv only on the first night of Yontif, first and second night of Yontif, and before that you don't know that he's not going to do it. It's only going to be relevant in the moment. And in the moment, it's Yontif. So it's Yontif, it's nighttime. So Bezdin, assuming that you need a Bezdin for Kriya, so Bezdin doesn't apply Onshin on Yontif. So what's Pshat? There's a whole back and forth about this. And one could address that issue as well by saying that it's not about Onesh, it's about encouraging proper behavior, and therefore maybe it's not really a function of Bezdin or an Onesh of Bezdin. Either way, two different ways of saying the distinction, whether it's an onesh of Bezdin or an onesh at all, but it's not really coming in that capacity, and therefore shouldn't have a yontif limitation. We mentioned the Ramban in his commentary to Yisro, when talking about this idea, uses the word merudin, suggesting that it's specifically because we're talking about people who are rebelling, and that's why we have perhaps a communal obligation in order to take action. It's also a question that we have to figure out about where it makes sense and where it doesn't make sense in terms of the Kiyum HaMitzvah. That if mitzvahs require kavana, so is it possible to have kavana that's exerted through forcing somebody to do it? Some suggest that we're not actually talking about forcing someone to do the mitzvah, but we're just bringing him to the front door, and then the mitzvah itself would have to be done willingly. The Sefer Achinuch has a fascinating comment from the Sefer Achinuch, that the Sefer Achinuch does talk about mitzvahs in general, but he talks about it in the mitzvah above, specifically in the context of Korban Pesach, and the Chinuch says that maybe it's most of a chiddush there, because beforehand we were talking about mitzvot that are result-oriented, kuravu and bris milah, things like that, mitzvot where you could say, okay, when it's about bringing about a certain result, so then we could understand more where kfiya has a role. But a mitzvah like Korban Pesach, which is more about the kfiya mitzvah, so I'm mentioning it there is to make the point that even when it's not about simply a result, but it's about the kfiya mitzvah in general, so that has particular relevance. And we spoke about the idea that the Nasik Shtetner has a tshuva, talking about bris milah, about the question of if you have an Israeli doctor had a surgery to perform on an elderly Jew, and he discovered that this Jew had not had a bris milah, and therefore asked the question, should he take it upon himself to impose the bris milah upon this person through his opportunity he's going to have through the surgery? And that also brought up all kinds of questions about whether or not this is a feasible plan. Now, practically speaking, he asserts very strongly it's not something you can do and get away with, and therefore it's off the table, pun intended. But he also, in that context, discusses that the whole question of whether or not it should be by a bris milah. And he quotes a Rashi, where Rashi talks about kfiya specifically in the context of the mitzvah shelespo chisar and kis, the mitzvah that doesn't cost too much. From prompting the question, is the tsar associated with bris milah comparable to something that costs too much? So why would we have that question in the first place? Why would we have that limitation? Why does that come up about something that costs too much? So we had a couple of suggestions why that should be a limitation. We mentioned that some interpret costing too much as costing more than a chomesh, a reference to a previous figure that we had, that just like mitzvot in general, you're not obligated in if they cost you too much of your existing money. So then you could say as well that that's the situation here, that that's what Rashi is talking about, that the person is essentially potter because of the cost, and therefore kfiya doesn't make sense. We mentioned a couple of other possibilities why you might make such a distinction. Perhaps also the idea is that we only want to do this if the person is really rebellious. And rebellious means he doesn't really have any good reason not to do it. He's just doing it lahachis, he's avoiding it lahachis. So then in such a circumstance that rises to the threshold of kviya. But if there is some kind of understandable reason why he's not doing it, because it costs a lot, even though we don't exempt him from the mitzvah because of that, but at least it's rational, it's an objection, it's not simply lachis, so then that's not a circumstance that calls for kfiya. We mentioned a third possibility also, which is going to be very relevant to the gittin question, that when it comes to kfiya, perhaps we want to be able to credibly say that this taps into the ratzon of the person, that this does reflect what he really wants to do. And therefore, as long as we can say that, okay, he's just refusing to do the mitzvah, but his inner rachon is to do the mitzvah, and once we force him, he's happy, so we have to be able to say that he's not paying any big price. So if he's paying a price of some big chutzas mamon, so then maybe that's going to undermine the ability to say that this kfiyas mitzvah is actually in line with what his inner rachon is. Which, again, is going to be a type of thinking we're going to see coming up in the context of Gittin as well. Okay, I think those are a lot of the major themes in terms of mitzvahs in general. Anything to add about that? To get to the and see this is a segue point, we'll mention that.
We have a little bit of a who is doing kfiya for mitzvahs.
Right, it's not saying that's an excuse for Mitzvahs. She also mentioned, so to segue into Gittin, so two major points. One is that the Rambam, the famous Rambam, we mentioned is probably one of the most famous Rambams in the whole Mishnah Torah, because it is often quoted in media reports in the secular literature, now the secular media today. Stories talking about the whole Gittin issue. So it's very possibly the most famous Rambam in the Mishnah Torah in the world level. But the Rambam, it says that in the context of get, that even though get requires ratzon, which it has in common with karbanos, by the way, important point, that both in terms of karbanos and in terms of gittin, we have a requirement of ratzon, and yet in both cases, the Gemara tells us that kfiyah is an option. So the Rambam says that despite that, we don't have to worry that the forced get is going to go against this concept of ratzon, because his inner pintaliyot, as we've been calling it, is desirous of doing mitzvos. So we've quoted a few times from the Sefer of Goldberg, Elo Shekof Lahotzi, more recently from another Sefer of his also, but from the Sefer Elo Shekof Lahotzi, in his introduction. He has two introductions, a more halachic and a more hashkafic one. So the more hashkafic one, he talks about this Rambam, and talks about how it melds with the whole idea that we have the Gemara in Maseches Shabbos and Daf Teches, where the Gemara tells us that the whole Torah was essentially forced upon us. And we, on the one hand, we were praised for saying Nasa V'Nishma. On the other hand, the Gemara tells us in Daf Teches and Shabbos that it was essentially forced upon us, that Kafu Aleihem Har Kigigis, that God turned the mountain over our heads and said, if you want to accept the Torah, it's going to be good for you, otherwise Sham Teik Varascha, and you're going to die here, it's not going to be a good arrangement. So apparently we were compelled to accept the Torah. And as we mentioned, it's interesting that it's up to the Rishonim to raise the question of why is that not a contradiction? So on the one hand, the Gemara says, Nasa V'Nishma, Torah says, Nasa V'Nishma twice, that we apparently willingly accepted it, and the Gemara says that that's a big source of credit for us. And the Gemara on the same daf, that's really what's striking, that the Gemara on the same daf in Shabbos mentions these two points side by side, as if there's no difficulty in sustaining the two, that we were compelled, and we deserve credit for Nasa V'Nishma. So how do you resolve that? So the Rishonim do raise the question. There's a measure, also the Tanchuma suggests a difference between Torah Shebachsav and Torah Shebachpeh, which are not so relevant to this point, but this is one of the approaches that you find in the Rishonim. But Tosfos on the Daf says that it was for later, that we were afraid that later on they wouldn't necessarily stay to their commitment. The Maral has a different approach, that it was about showing them how absolutely fundamental it was to life. But there's another Mahalach which I think was consistent with what he writes over there in the introduction, and consistent also with that mention we said about Torah Shavasad and Torah Shavasad, that the idea being that there was an inner ratzon to take the Torah. The fact was that the Jews deserve praise for being interested in the Torah at all when the other nations of the world said nothing doing. But there wasn't a full appreciation that it has to be a blanket commitment, that it has to come with not just a appreciation for what you've seen, but a recognition that that means the whole totality of commitment. We compared it to marriage. I think I mentioned the time that I spoke about this in Afrif, and Parshas Mishpatim or Parshas Yisrael along the same lines, that marriage is the same idea, that the couple, and it's really the topic of our whole Masechta in that sense, and it's really what all Masechta's Tzuvos is about, that you have, and it's what Kedushin and Tzuvos is about, that the couple is interested in each other, that they deserve credit for seeing each other's milas enough that they want to be together at all, but both the Torah and the Chazal, we've just been discussing the first man about how it's some mixture of a din d'oraisa and a din d'rabbanan. The Torah says it's great that you see such wonderful qualities in this spouse, but and this person you're interested in, but that's not enough. You have to make a full-time 24/7 commitment, and that's the next step. So So it's not a contradiction to say you have to be forced into that commitment while also giving you credit for being interested in the first place. So that's kind of the structure that we have here, that the Pintel Yid wants to do mitzvahs right now. They are forgetting about that, so the Rambam says we have to kind of chase away the Yitzhara, and that's what the Kfiyah is going to accomplish. Okay, so far so good. Any questions, anything? Any issues? Okay, so a major, major question is, who does the Kfiyah? So is the Kfiyah something that every individual could do? Is the Kfiyah something that only Beis Din could do? Or is it somewhere in between? Is it something that Beis Din in action, a functionary of Beis Din can do? Does it carry out as a function of Beis Din? Or is it the assessment has to be done by Beis Din? There was a position of the Sefer Yerayim that makes it sound like it has to be Beis Din Smukum in Eretz Yisrael. Question whether he meant that literally or not. The idea of Smukum, we do find, the Gemara says in Gittin, that a get requires Smukum, theoretically. That you need a Beis Din of not just the Dayanim, but of ordained Dayanim, which nowadays we have none of, with all due respect to the YU Smicha program. We don't have any actual ordainees from Moshe Rabbeinu, but the Gemara also, this is the first Sugya for next year, first Sugya in Sanhedrin, but the Gemara says there's a concept called Shlichu Sayhu, which somehow confers the authority of the Smuchim on Dayanim outside of Eretz Yisrael and Dayanim today, who are not smuchim, literally sounds like it means shlichus, or shechter and others explain it doesn't mean that, it's a different principle. But whatever it is, there's some type of mechanism that allows contemporary dayanin to function through the authority of smuchim. But we don't forget that that's what's needed for a kfiyah by a get. The question, by the way, parenthetically, of whether a get by itself that doesn't involve kfiyah, whether a get needs Beis Din, is actually a subject of machlokes, and that also happens to be a topic on Daf Beis in Sanhedrin for other reasons. It has to do with how you read a Mishnah in the first Mishnah of Sanhedrin. So the question nowadays, you know, we always associate the Beis Din with get, the get with Beis Din, so it's the automatic assumption that a get needs Beis Din. It's not so obvious that that's the case to make a din. That's a little bit of a more complex discussion, but let's assume for practical purposes, a get needs a Beis Din, and kfiya for a get needs a Beis Din. But what about mitzvahs in general? Is it possible to say that an individual could do it? You mentioned that the Amshul Shlomo emphasizes, the Marashal emphasizes, that even if there is a possibility that we could use actual kfiya by an individual, that it wouldn't sound to be an individual, it would have to be an individual with a very high level of Yir Shemayim and a very serious madrega of commitment, and I think it's safe to assume that none of us are on that madrega for practical purposes. So the question of whether it's a fee or not, so this was a major machlokes between the Ksos and the Nesivis. So, as we noted, we are privileged to have the Ksos and the Nesivis essentially function as really a tremendous vehicle that we have to learn about any topic that's related at all to Kosher Mishpat. Somehow it works out that the Ksos and the Nesivis are always able to explore all the different sides of the issue and to land on different sides of so many issues of Kosher Mishpat, that there's such a constant theme of the Ksos and the Nesivis finding different ways to look at the dinim and to therefore force us to really give full attention and to flesh out the different possibilities. And we are also zoichet to have a couple of rounds of the debate. So the Ksos will say something and the Nesivis will disagree. And then we'll have a Meshovev Nesivis where the Ksos will come back again and say why he still thinks he's right. So this is one of those cases that the Ksos maintains that one needs a Beis Din for kfiya, and that Beis Din cannot be, and kfiya, sorry, cannot be done by an individual. So the Nesivis disagrees, and the Nesivis brings a raya from a Gemara that sounds like an individual can do kfiya. And the Ksos responds, and the Meshovei Nesivos says, no, that's not talking about kfiya like we've been talking about now, that's talking about hafrasha me iser. The other side of the equation, if somebody is involved in an avera, so there may be an individual can't stop him. Again, even that I would exercise with great caution. But a get, but kfiya requires a bezdin. And he says, how do you know that? Because a get clearly requires a bezdin, otherwise it's going to be a get musa. And he's apparently working off the assumption that get is functioning based on kfiya b'mitzvos, which is not necessarily the only way to see things, but that's the major premise that the Ketzos expresses in the Meshobeg Nesivos, which led to a lot of discussion. So there are a couple of major points that emerge from that Ketzos. One is the assumption that kfiya b'mitzvos is the basis for kfiya b'get, and the second, maybe even more questionable, is the assumption that even if that's true, that should mean that all mitzvos have the same standard. So it could be that you could say that kfiya by a get requires a bezdin, even if it's an expression of kfiya by mitzvos, and still say that other mitzvos don't need a bezdin, at least theoretically, because there are differences. So what differences did we discuss? Right, so remember, we discussed a few differences why you might say that it applies to a get and not to other mitzvos. So, yes, Tamir?
I think you mentioned Ben-Al-Machaberim, Ben-Al-Machaberim.
Right, so that was one of the ones you mentioned towards the end, that Gartner, say, Kfiya Beget, makes that distinction, that maybe if we're talking about evaluating an issue that's a fight between people, so you need a bezdin for that purpose, but general mitzvahs, which don't involve other interested parties, so maybe you don't require a bezdin. Again?
You said that Pitim has a requirement of Ashi and Merotzah, and
that's also... Right, that's also another major issue that we'll have to figure out. That maybe the requirement of ratzon, which is relevant to get, and to karban, is not necessarily indicative of the standard of other mitzvos, and maybe that doesn't necessarily carry over. What else? Amir?
You mentioned that get doesn't have a specific yiv.
So that's also a possibility, right? That maybe when it comes to mitzvos in general, the chiyuv is much clearer. And maybe when you're talking about sukkah or lulav or something like that, so then we can see, all right, there's a clear fee if this person is neglecting. But it's not always going to be the case. Maybe it'll sometimes be the case. Maybe it won't, but it won't always be the case that the case of the get is a clear fee. So therefore, in order to establish if it's going to be based on the mitzvah l'shmoa, different chachamim, so then maybe we need a bezd in order to establish that, while mitzvahs in general, maybe we don't. Adin?
Just in general, the Ketzos is trying to draw a parallel between Gittin and Kfiya. He's saying that because giving a get requires a based in, then Kfiya will also be a based in. So why do we necessarily care about what all mitzvahs in general, the differences between Gittin and all mitzvahs and Korban and all mitzvahs in general? Shouldn't we be looking for direct parallels or differences between Kfiya and get?
Well, the question is basically whether Ketzos is right, you know, because he's trying to prove his point based on that. And the question is, why does the Nesivos not agree? And is the Ketzos' point compelling? So that's what we want to figure out. So even if premise one is true, that the basis for kfiya by a get is the mitzvah, does that necessarily mean that all mitzvahs have to have the same standard? It could be that other mitzvahs, maybe there's some difference.
Well,
especially in light of the fact that the Nesivos disagrees.
Even if all the mitzvahs are different, it doesn't necessarily disprove the Ketzos' point.
It doesn't necessarily at this point prove A. At this point, prove disprove point A. Again, there's two premises that emerge from Ketzos. One is that get is based on mitzvos, and two is that mitzvos therefore can be derived from get because it's the same standard. So point A may or may not be true, but even if point A is true, point B is a little shakier. That maybe kfiya for get is based on it being a mitzvah, but doesn't mean that that's the only way to address mitzvos. Maybe other mitzvos have an easier standard for kfiya. So that's where those differences have to be examined in order to know whether or not the Ketzos is applicable across the board, especially in light of the fact that the Nesivos disagree. So we have to at least figure out why the Nesivos disagree. So I was saying a few minutes ago that we're blessed to have the Ketzos and the Nesivos that force us to pay attention to every side, to both at least two sides of every issue in the Chosh and Mishpah, because they're always there to, for one to take one side and one to take the other side. It's really quite a pellet to watch just how often this happens, so it forces you to take each side seriously. So the Nesivos is forcing us to consider, why is this social point not obvious? So a number of those distinctions are relevant, therefore, to understanding why that might be the case. So how indeed, then, to segue from there into get, which I think we're willing to do. Are we ready to do any other points to bring up? And we have to figure out exactly how the mitzvah works by get. That's a different topic. You know, the question, what is the mitzvah? That's something that we'll address separately. But, so, assuming that there is this concept of kviya by get, which we know from a few places. The Gemara Maseches Erechin tells us that there is a concept of kofen ad shiyomer rotzani. Just parenthetically, though, even though the Gemara says ad shiyomer rotzani, sounds like that's an explicit requirement, like the Rambam quotes, there are those who question that because the context of the Gemara in Erechin is that this individual had also said he doesn't want to give the get. So we have to contradict his modah that the get is not willing, but it doesn't necessarily mean there's always an obligation to compel rotzani. So we'll address the rotzani point separately. But the question of, so how exactly does the kfir work by a get? So there are a number of views in the Rishonim, which, as we said, may overlap. We're not necessarily going to maintain that they constitute completely different views, but we'll consider that question as well. And all of this is in light of the fact that the Gemara tells us, a little bit less directly, but we know from a few Gemaras, that a get requires ratzon, just like a korban does. The Rishonim have different diukim from the pasuk. Is it because of a kasav law? The Nasan, how exactly do we see that somehow the verbs tell us it's got to be Barotso, but there are Mishnayos throughout Shas and Gemaras throughout Shas which certainly take it as a given that a get has to be given from the Ratzon of the Ba. So how exactly does it work that theoretically we could force a get, if that's the case, if it needs Ratzon? So one of the major Gemaras that certainly Shekhazer inside, because it's crucial to understanding a lot of everything else, was the Gemara Maseches Bava Basra, and that Mem Zayin continues, where the Gemara talks about the question of Tiluhu Dezavin Zvini Zvini, that if somebody is pressured to sell something, so that sale is ultimately valid. Which, parenthetically, the Gemara is itself interesting on a couple of levels, because the Gemara addresses the question that, well, maybe we should say that, of course, that's true, because every sale is essentially not of your own free will, because the assumption is that people would hold on to what they had unless they have a compelling need for money. So because they need money, they're forced to sell their property, but if they didn't need money, then they wouldn't sell the property. So that shows you that really every sale is done under duress, and yet sales are theoretically valid. There's such a thing as selling things. So it must be that sale is valid under duress, because otherwise no sale would ever be valid. So just that discussion in the Gemara is parenthetically interesting. I think we probably mentioned the psychological principle of the endowment effect, the idea that people want to hold on to something even more than they want to buy it in the first place. So that's itself interesting. But the assumption that free will could be addressed on such a subtle level that even just the desire for money in exchange for this object is on some level coercive, because if it were not for your need for money, you wouldn't get rid of it. And this just reminds us that we didn't really get off the topic. It'll have to be really our first sugya in June's mind. The major, major question of how onus mamon factors into forcing a get, one of the major elements of the prenup, subject we didn't have time to fully explore. But what exactly is our attitude towards the need for money and the desire to hold on to one's money? How exactly does that affect free will, affect ratzon? So the Gemara already addresses a little bit, or alludes to that question by saying that every sale could be viewed as duress, and yet sales are valid. But then the Gemara says, no, okay, but still you need the money, but then you decide, okay, you'd rather have the money than the object, so that's free will. But what if you wouldn't have made that decision either, except for the fact that somebody is compelling you to sell? So should we say that that the sale is valid anyway, and that's how we assume that, yes, that ultimately once the person gets to that point where he's selling it, even though he didn't want to be selling it, then that sale is still considered to be valid. And we emphasize the time that the Gemara certainly seems to be discussing this outside the context of Issur V'Heter, because it would seem that this is a violation of Osachmo. It would seem that somebody who would force somebody to sell something, at least to himself, you could say that Gemara is talking about forcing somebody to sell something to somebody else, like the government sometimes does, right? Sometimes the government decides they have a monopoly that's unacceptable, or you have a situation where, and this came up like with the owner of the basketball team, and that was the big story in the news a few months ago.
That
right. Yeah. You know? So sometimes you have somebody who is told by the government or by some other authoritative body that we're not taking something away from him, but we're forcing him to sell it. So theoretically, you could have somebody who forces you to sell something to a third party, or if you force somebody to sell something to you, it would seem like that's a violation of Los Achmo. That's one of the Asaras Adibros. But that's a different topic. So point being that we're not going to talk about the Issa Beheter component here. Yes?
Isn't that different, though, because theoretically, by being part of that organization, you signed the contract.
Yeah, maybe.
You would have to sell in a certain time.
Is that part of the contract? I have no idea. Maybe. But either way, whether it's true or not, just highlighting the point of the idea of forcing someone to sell, so that could happen by a third party. It could be that some other party has an interest in compelling you to sell something. Or it could be probably more likely that usually you want something yourself, so you're trying to force somebody else to sell it to you. So forcing somebody to sell something to you is usually a violation of Los Achmod. And if that's the case, so we're not addressing here the question of whether this is permissible or not, just the question of whether or not this is a valid sale. Hi.
Can you say that there's a difference, though, between a sale and get? Because by get, there's a mitzvah and the Torah, and therefore, since that person's a Jew and he's required to abide by those laws, that's as if, you know, he must abide by them.
Not only can you say that, but that's what the Gemara says. And I said, like Gemara Rabba Basha, the Gemara wants to know that how do we know this halacha that a person can be forced to sell something? So the Gemara ultimately concludes this is svara. But before getting to that, the Gemara tries to learn it out from a few other places. So one place tries to learn it out from Karban. So then the Gemara says, no, maybe Karban is not a good example because you ultimately get to Kapara, so that's generally more desirable than other things. Or the Gemara says, what about get? So since we know that a get can be forced, doesn't that show you somebody can be forced to sell something? So to that the Gemara says no, that the get, yes, mitzvah l'shmor d'bere chacham. So that might be different than, that's essentially your point, right? That might be different than a normal sale. So that line in the Gemara, there's a lot of discussion just how much to read into that line. When the Gemara says mitzvah l'shmor d'bere chacham, does that mean that is the basis for the authority of kfiyah for get? Does that mean that's always true by kfiyah for get? Or is Gemara just saying it's not a good model for a sale, or it's not an absolute model for sale because of that element, but it doesn't necessarily have broader implications? So there's a lot of discussion how much weight to put on that phrase that appears in the Gemara. Again, I cannot encourage you strongly enough in your chazar, you know, clearly you want to chazar the Gemara, like I said, with notes in this Chazar is to supplement, should at least be Chazaring the Gemaras themselves, and it was very much included in that list. The Gemara for this sugya, you should certainly see the Gemara in Bava Basra, which is very important to see inside. The Gemara in Erechin is very important to see inside. All of these Gemaras, one should certainly have a direct familiarity with. So, that being the case, so the Rishonim over there discuss in Bava Basra what exactly is going on here. So the Rashbam has the statement that essentially this works because it's basically there's no benefit to the person who is in this marriage because the very important language of the Rashbam that essentially there's no functional marriage. She hates him and she's not doing anything with him. So therefore he's not benefiting and all he's doing is hurting her by keeping her in this relationship. So, therefore, it is legitimate to force the get under those circumstances. So, is this consistent with other Rishonim? Is it supplementing other Rishonim? That's a little bit of an open question, but this is an important statement about the mechanism. We mentioned that it's not explicit in his words, but it's just interesting to compare this to what we find elsewhere in Shas, the idea of kofen on midas tom, that it seems like what the Rashbam is essentially describing is what we call midas tom elsewhere, that midas tom is generally defined in various places in Shas as zanena v'zelo chaser, a situation where somebody else could benefit and it's not going to hurt you one way or another, which, as I think I mentioned, there are different sugyas and shas that use the phrase. In some, it sounds more about, it's about cruelty, like you don't want somebody else to benefit even though you would not gain. And in other cases, it's less obviously cruel, it's just unjustified, that basically you want somebody else to benefit you, even though you're not giving up anything, you want somebody else's benefit to be a source of profit for you. And the Gemara says it's not justified because you didn't lose anything to justify the profit. Both models are possibly relevant to considering some of the contemporary questions of recalcitrant husbands. But in any event, so it's interesting just to consider what is the parallelism here between Kof and Almidas Dom, the fact that the Rashbam is describing a situation which is very similar to what we describe as Zenen and Vizelo Chaser. And in some of the contexts, not all of them, the Gemara has the phrase Kof and Almidas Dom, that the Bezdin compels you not to act like those who are associated with stone. And therefore, that could be essentially what the Rashbam is alluding to, that this is a Midas Dom behavior, to hold her in a marriage that's not benefiting you at all. And therefore, the Beis Din is acting appropriately in terms of kfiyah. That won't necessarily address the Ratzon issue, but maybe addresses a little bit why the Beis Din is going to want to be kof in the first place. Okay, so far so good. Any questions about that? So then we noted Tosus on the other side of the page. So Tosus raised the question that really, the Gemara has two different standards. There is Tliu V'Zavin, we're talking about Mecher, we're talking about you're selling something. So then you can say, okay, you're selling something and you get the money, so ultimately you're okay with it. Ultimately you came to grips with this trade-off. But we don't apply this to Matana, that if you're forced to give something as a gift without any payback, so then it's not so clear that this should be the din. So shouldn't the case of a get be more comparable to that? More comparable, you're giving something unilaterally. So isn't that more like a gift rather than a mitzvah? So Tosfos has two answers. One we didn't spend so much time on. That it's more of a transaction because you have monetary obligations towards the spouse and you're released from that. So it's comparable to mecher for that reason, because it's like you're getting paid in order to carry out this transaction. But the other answer of Tosfos is particularly interesting. Tosfos says that mitzvah is kemecher. So if there's a mitzvah, then it's in the mecher category. So why should it be in the mecher category? So we mentioned the Rashash, that the Rashash said that because mitzvahs are worth money, like we find that if somebody steals a mitzvah from you, so then they have to pay you a sar zehuvim. You're about to circumcise your eight-day-old baby, and all of a sudden somebody comes with a knife and says, oh look, an eight-day-old baby, I think I'll circumcise him. So he steals your mitzvah, so he has to pay you 10 gold coins, a sar zehuvim. So to here, you should also recognize that mitzvahs are worth money, so it's like a sale. So that's how the Rosh Hashanah understands it. We mentioned that you could maybe understand it a different way. I'm not sure which way is more correct. And we gave the comparison of the Gemara and Bava Kamma. The Gemara says in Bava Kamma that you have an obligation to watch lost property. If you find somebody's Aveda, so you have an obligation to watch it. So there is a machlokas in the Gemara. So when you're watching it, you're a shomer, so you consider it to be a shomer chinam because nobody's paying you. Or, for some reason, are you considered to be a shomer socher? So why would you be considered to be a shomer socher? Nobody's paying you. So the Gemara has two answers. One is a fruit of the Rav Yosef. Interesting idea. You may actually end up profiting because you'll be excused from stucca. I bring things back full circle. It would be excused from stucca because of your involvement in mitzvah. Or the other answer of the Gemara is Rahman and Meshavri, that the Torah has committed him. So I think in that Gemara there's two ways to understand it. That one, you could say that this chus of the mitzvah is considered to be like payment, so therefore you're considered to be a Shomer Sacher, which is similar to what the Rashash says in this Tosus. Or you could say it differently. You could say that it has to do with the obligation. The Torah says, normally, when you take on something voluntarily, so then you have a lower level of obligation. But here, the mitzvah is mechayiv you. So the mitzvah is telling you, you have to do this, and you have to take it on with this higher level of commitment. So to here, maybe we could say that matana is when you choose voluntarily to give something or not. But here, if the Torah commands you, you got to do it. So then that's comparable to a mutual transaction, whether or not there's any benefit going both ways. So maybe just two different ways to understand what that Tosfos is getting at. Okay, so far so good. Questions?
Yeah. Nothing? I didn't understand. What would be the connection to
the Yosef here? We just go to the focus on the other answer. The other answer, Rahman and Meshavdei, and the idea is, whatever that means, so what does that mean? So we mentioned two possibilities of what it means. Either it means that the schus of the mitzvah is like payment, so if you're doing a mitzvah, Shomer Saveda, you're considered to be a Shomer Sacher, it's like you're paid because the mitzvah gives you credit. Or we say, no, you're not getting paid, but you're considered to be a Shomer Sacher because the Torah obligates you, and therefore it obligates you at this higher threshold. It's not something you can choose to say, oh, I'm doing it voluntarily, so limit my obligations. So I think both interpretations are also possible in this answer in Tosfos in Bava Basra, that either it's considered to be like Mecher because there's value in you through the mitzvah, or it's considered to be like Mecher because it's not voluntary. It's something that you commit to willingly, and I mean commit to as a function of mitzvah rather, and therefore it has a status like Mecher. Okay, any questions about that? So then the third position in the Rishonim is the famous view of the Rambam that it is the mitzvah that does it, which seems to be another position. And then the question is also, what mitzvah are we talking about? So that gets into a much larger discussion that the Chassam Sofer has a tshuva where he suggests that the mitzvah of V'ahavta L'Reicha Kamocha, we mentioned the tshuva Svayan David, it's a rabbi from Antwerp, David Weiss, where he assumes that that's not the way we work off of. We don't work off the premise that V'ahavtarech kamocha is the basis for kfiyah beget for various reasons, and it's more likely it's a mitzvah l'shmoa divrei chachamim that we have, and it talks about how the Avnei Nezer had said that we need kfiyah for rotza ani. He needs to say rotza ani because the issue is that we're worried that the ratzon component. So if a person doesn't want to do it, so kfiya is going to run up against the problem of ratzon, and he assumes that the shlichu sayhu that the Gemara talks about, that only works drabanan. The Reisa were still in trouble. So therefore we need him to say rotzani, because dvarim shevalei v'inam dvarim, that whatever he's thinking doesn't count. Again, we said apologies to the Neo Hasidus, dvarim shevalei v'inam dvarim, that it's only the outside words that matter. So as long as he says Rotzani, that will serve as the basis for Ratzon, and therefore we need him to say it. And the undoubted question that also, because it says ultimately it doesn't matter whether it's a methodology of the Reisa or Rabbanim, it's based on the mitzvah of Shmoa Divrei Chachamim, so then ultimately that mitzvah is coming in the Torah of the Rabbanim, but it's here, so it should work. And otherwise, we have a problem with Dvarim Shebelev and Dvarim, because we say Dvarim Shebelev Havi Dvarim when it's an Umda. So when it's very clear, we can all see that he's screaming, I'm not interested, so there's a lot more than Dvarim Shebelev, so that's not going to necessarily work otherwise. So he's assuming it's Mitzvah Shmoa Divrei Chachamim that's active. We also mentioned at some point that in various other contexts, we'll come back to this point, and we'll come back to the point in June also, that sometimes the kfiya operates based on the idea that if he has spousal obligations that he's not carrying out, so then the kfiya is justified based on the idea that we could say we can be kofa on the obligations that he took upon himself that are in the ksuba and elsewhere. And there you could say that the kfiya means either do it or release it, either fulfill the obligations or let her go, and therefore that kfiya would not be considered kfiya on the get, that would be considered kfiya on the obligations. So that is a third possibility, and then that gets us to the fourth basic view that we found in the Rishonim, that the view of the Rabbaz, that the Rabbaz seems to say that it's premised on afkinu, that the times when we're called for the get is because Chazal have negated the marriage, and therefore the get is not really, strictly speaking, necessary. And I have to figure out what exactly it means. It's not necessary, because clearly it is necessary, but it's not necessary in the same way. It doesn't have to be Berotzen, because Chazal apparently did the heavy lifting already. And we'll get more into this, but in the Sefer Eilat Shekhov from Hotzi, so he works off this premise that it's an idea of Afkinu, and he quotes a number of other Rishonim, which he thinks are also working off that premise that it's Afkinu. He mentions Rishonim, well, of course, there's proofs in a minute, or maybe next time permitting, but we saw that Rabbi Gartner, his Sefer, so he thinks the Rabbaz doesn't mean Afkinu, that Rabbaz is basically saying that when the marriage is essentially not a marriage for the wife, so when it's not Yishus on that side, so then we are called for the husband to give up the Yishus on his side, that the kinyan Yishus that he has to relinquish if it's not Yishus for the wife, and that that's what the Afkinu reference means, and that he doesn't think it's actually functioning based on Afkinu. So just to say the points we can say more quickly, so we should mention that the usage of Afkinu is a topic for June, but the suggestion that Afkinu could work by itself nowadays, that we could say that that some rabbinical body could declare a marriage null and void based on Afkinu was a highly controversial topic. That the Gemara mentions Afkinu, which was on the Chaim Goldberg pointed out, mentions it in two contexts, two types of contexts. One is at the moment of marriage, that the whole marriage never gets off the ground, and that Chazal declared it an invalid way to marry someone. And the other context is when you have a marriage that has existed for some time. So that happens specifically through a get. So to use it nowadays for existing marriages, as Rizam Nechemi argued, would not work unless there's also a get involved. So that's essentially what the Rabbi seems to say, that through the get, so there is either Afkinu or something else, as Gartner is suggesting. So just the point that we'll have to pick up on for tomorrow, just to set the stage, is there is a major machlokus as to the scope of when kfiyah beget works. So we have a couple of different statements in Chazal about kfiyah beget. We have the Mishnah Nayin Zayin, which clearly lays out certain cases where kfiyah is indicated, and certain types of physical conditions where the assumption is that the wife is not able to endure them, and therefore, there has to be a kfiyah beget, assuming that that's what she wants at least, then a get should be forced. And it's a major machlokus whether or not this is expanded beyond that. That on the one hand, so there are those who take a very strict position that it's literally only the cases that are mentioned in Chazal, both in that Mishnah and a handful of other places where you find kfiyah beget in both. In Chazal and Bavli and Yerushalmi. And there are those who will expand it. So you can expand it two ways. One way to expand it is to say that there are other categories that are kind of a Kal v'chomer from these categories, or are included in these categories. These categories as general, but inclusive of other things. So, for example, the Yerushalmi mentions a Kal v'chomer to Eini Zan v'Eini Osa, that he says, Eini Zan v'Eini Farnes, I'm not going to support my wife. So then we should say that that's a Kal v'chomer from the cases that you find. Others discuss just how far that goes. We mentioned the highly mechudish position that was shared both by the Zikan Aram Halevi, quoted the Kol from Mahotzi, and Reshech Tashlita, that you could apply kfiyah for couples not living together, which is a very mechudish position, because that's essentially also what's alluded to in these Mishnayos. But the more expansive position is to say that it exists also by a situation of Ma'at Salai. We'll have to say a lot more about Ma'at Salai, but the very Mechudish Rambam, or a different Rambam, the one we mentioned until now, another comment to the Rambam, is that one can be kofeh for a statement of Ma'at Salai. What that means, we'll have to explain in more detail probably tomorrow. And there's also some Rishonim who say there was a takana to be kofa on Ma'at Salai, so we'll have to expand on where all that goes. Okay, any questions so far? All right, so far so good. So we got a lot done today, so hopefully we should be on schedule. It's Tuesday today, by the way, so what kind of Tuesday schedule should we have? Is it college week?
Yeah, Tuesday's the last day.
Oh, Tuesday's the walking, so fine, so we'll have regular Tuesday. Okay. I'm not sure if you're going to have a